The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 4th of March 2021 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's programme, heightened security in Washington, D.C. as the FBI warns of another potential plot to take the Capitol building later today. We'll look at how the QAnon threat is mutating. Also ahead...
I'm the Latin America-based correspondent at Monocle, Lucinda Elliott, and today I'm taking a look at Chile, a country whose speedy vaccination program is one of the most successful in the world, and what the rollout may mean for voters when they head to the polls this year.
Plus, we'll take a look at the latest business news, and it's that time of the week again.
Hello, I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and for today's Global Countdown, we're heading to Togo for the first time.
Yes, we're going to go to Togo. One take that was. That's all coming up right here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. And welcome to today's edition of The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. It is a commonplace of cults of all kinds that the errors of their prophecies do not daunt their adherents. They simply tweak the details and pick a new date and await deliverance afresh. In the US, the Trumpist cult QAnon, having failed to take the Capitol on January the 6th or seen their hero round up the deep state Satanist cabal which secretly controls the world on Inauguration Day, had lately drawn a red circle around today, March the 4th, on which they believe Donald Trump will return to the White House and resume his presidency. Spoiler alert, he won't. Nevertheless, FBI intelligence about another possible plot to storm the Capitol has resulted in the implementation of extra security. Well, I'm joined with more on this by Geoffrey Howard, political philosopher at University College London. Geoffrey, with all due acknowledgement of the perils of taking any of the QAnon and associated nonsense seriously, why were they excited about March the 4th?
Well, March the 4th has a particular role to play in the broader QAnon story. And the short version of it is that March the 4th was the original inauguration date for the US presidency. So George Washington's inauguration was scheduled for March the 4th, 1789. As it happens, it didn't actually occur, in fact, due to bad weather. And so it had to be postponed to April. But for nearly 150 years, March the 4th was the inauguration date for the presidency until the 20th Amendment, which was enacted in 1933, changed the inauguration date to January 20th for the re-election of Franklin Roosevelt. And so it's part of a broader aspect of the QAnon ideology, which very much anchors it as in the American past. In particular, before 1971, the QAnon followers believe that the U.S. government has been wholly illegitimate since the presidency of Ulysses S. Grant for very complicated and bizarre reasons we could get into. But it's that idea of March the 4th as the original, the right inauguration date for the American presidency that has given it such prominence in the QAnon ideology.
Well, it's good to know they've got another date in April to fall back on when it doesn't work out today. Always nice to have the option in your pocket.
Well, isn't that the story of QAnon, though? We just get... a constant series of predictions that never come to fruition. Isn't that the story of any kind of unhinged cult ideology and conspiracy theory? The prediction doesn't come true, and so they improvise and they change their prediction, and so we get a new date. It's almost like whoever's in charge is just making it up as he goes along to keep people enthralled and to keep people watching.
Nevertheless, we are obliged to take it seriously. Certainly the people whose job is securing the capital and the people who work in it are obliged to take it seriously, the more so since January the 6th. What do we know about the nature of the threat today, literally today?
Well, we know that it was serious enough to inspire the House leaders to cancel a vote or to move a vote that was going to take place today on Wednesday night so lawmakers could get out of town. No doubt, in part, this was the Capitol Police feeling quite bruised from the events of January the 6th, the flagrant inability to keep the Capitol safe on that day. I suspect that intelligence agencies are being cautious here. But I don't think they would have canceled it if there weren't some indication that there was a real threat. And that should be really quite alarming for us. The cancellation itself is quite alarming. It sends a terrible message that the U.S. government is so weak that it can't even protect its democratic legislative process, that at the slightest inclination of some, or perhaps a quite substantial inclination, that there's going to be an attack of some kind, the response is to alter the schedule of U.S. legislators rather than try to beef up security. One would have thought that the right response, or at least a plausible response, would have been to have a strong show of force to send a clear message that, no, you cannot threaten the legislative process in the United States and expect it to be shut down. So in one sense, the moving of the legislative session is in part a victory for QAnon, because it shows that it retains that kind of power over American democracy. And you just have to make the point that's been made again and again over the past few years. Just imagine if you saw it in another country. You can see the headline: forces loyal to the previous regime threaten another attack on the legislature, forcing it to cancel its sessions. I mean, that would be an indication of a democracy in crisis. And yet it is what we're facing in the United States today.
I mean, it was probably always a forlorn hope that Trump leaving office would prompt a widespread calming of the heck down. But is it actually possible that QAnon might become even more dangerous in defeat?
It's certainly possible. One thing we are seeing is that QAnon is splintering, that it is experiencing much more internal disagreement. One faction of QAnon has even suggested, in order to adhere to its initial promise about Trump retaining power on January the 20th, that maybe Trump and Biden have somehow switched bodies. And so the current, who appears to be President Biden in office, is in fact Trump continuing to pull the strings. And indeed, some people in the QAnon movement have argued that March the 4th isn't particularly important, no doubt arguing that in order to avoid another disappointment like last time. So on the one hand, it does seem like we're seeing increasing disillusionment and splintering within the QAnon movement. On the other hand, we do see greater chatter on social media, greater chatter on various internet channels, boding violence. And certainly January 6th galvanized a lot of people. And so we're seeing increases in militia activity. The FBI Director Wray was commenting on this just the other day, that domestic extremism is on the rise in the United States of America. So whether in the guise of QAnon or not, the prospect of far-right extremist movements being a serious challenge in the United States over the next few years is clearly something we have to take seriously, notwithstanding the lunacy of some of the conspiracy thinking.
Jeffrey Howard at UCL, thanks as always for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing. Here is Monocle's Yolin Goffan with the day's other headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. Myanmar's generals have said they are ready to withstand economic sanctions and diplomatic isolation following last month's military coup. It comes as the United Nations urges the international community to take very strong measures to restore democracy in the Southeast Asian nation. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has announced a plan to relax COVID-19 restrictions following a lengthy meeting with Germany's 16 state premiers. However, German business groups have expressed concern about the pace of the easing and say it could have a devastating impact on their members. Loyalist paramilitary organizations have told the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson they are temporarily withdrawing support for Northern Ireland's historic Good Friday Agreement. The move comes amid concerns over the controversial Northern Ireland Protocol, which governs post-Brexit trade. And Switzerland's parliament has agreed to provide an additional 120 million Swiss francs in financial aid to media companies. It comes amid a raft of other support measures in recognition of the value of a thriving media scene to Swiss society. For more, head to monocle.com/minute. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Yolene. You are listening to The Briefing. It's time now for one of our looks at what is making the news in Latin America, specifically this week in Chile. Well, I'm joined to do exactly that by Monocle's Latin America Affairs correspondent, Lucinda Elliott. Lucinda, we were discussing earlier this week Chile's impressive response vis-a-vis vaccination. What are the local papers saying about it across the region? Is Chile being held up as an example of people saying, why can't the rest of us do this?
Well, perhaps unsurprisingly, Andrew, they haven't been saying all too much about Chile, possibly to not draw attention to their own failings. I mean, much of South America is struggling to vaccinate its population. Where I am in Uruguay, for example, they only started the rollout on Monday this week. Meanwhile, in Brazil, a minute fraction of the population has received a jab since early February. I mean, the city of São Paulo of some 20 million people has given out around 700,000 jabs so far. But Chile's program is one of the most successful in the world. We have more than 17% of its 19 million or so citizens who've been inoculated with the first dose so far.
And President Sebastián Piñera was not all that long ago not looking terrifically popular. There were large-scale protests against him and his doings. Is this improving his stature at all?
Yeah, so this fairly speedy government response could be good news for the centre-right billionaire president, Sebastián Piñera. He has been suffering, as you say, very low approval ratings and faced a massive and unexpected wave of public anger against social inequality at the end of 2019 and into last year, with widespread protests that involved a litany of complaints from the cost of metro fares to the declining real income from private pensions. And Piñera's first response then, following the sort of firebombing of several metro stations in Santiago, was repression. Yet his far-sighted and arguably pragmatic approach this year in securing vaccines looks like it not only will boost Chile's economic recovery, but also the right's political standing and his popularity ahead of the elections, which are scheduled for November.
Well, indeed so, because there is no way that this is not going to become an election thing, not just in Chile, but in countries around the world, depending on whether a vaccine rollout goes well or badly. But Piñera himself is not running, is that right?
Yeah, so Piñera himself will not seek a new term. Candidates are still to be determined. I think they have until July to put themselves forward. But the next candidate to emerge from Piñera's centre-right coalition now could have a revived chance of winning. I mean, that it's still a way away. It's worth saying that last year, after boasting of positive early results when the pandemic first hit, Chile's mortality rate rose very quickly. And we still have all these new variants. But at this rate, with a good chunk of the population protected from the virus, the potential opening up of businesses ahead of the election shows how an effective pandemic response can really prompt a reversal of political fortunes for leaders and their party, something we actually mentioned in the Monocle Minute on Tuesday.
I mean, it's also going to be an exciting period for constitutional nerds in Chile, and let's face it, who isn't? Because, of course, they had that referendum last October, if memory serves, about whether or not they wanted to ditch the constitution, which was drafted during the Pinochet era, and come up with something new. The country voted overwhelmingly yes, but what have they come up with, and where are we with that?
Yeah, so Chileans hope that a new constitution will be able to fix the deep inequalities in the country. The current constitution, which was written 40 years ago in the middle of the brutal rule of General Pinochet, remains profoundly polarizing. It actually helped secure his power for another decade. But the process is likely to be drawn out and deeply complicated. At the moment, we have a constituent assembly that's been set up. They have a year to write the new document, which will then be subject to a referendum in 2022, so after this presidential election. But given all the complications brought on by the pandemic, that could slow the process further. And then if in 2022 that document is rejected, the 1980 constitution will remain in force, which puts Chile's activists back to square one. So at the minute, it's in the writing process.
I mean, there's no way, obviously, that any country can do something like this without an absolutely unholy row attending it, which is why I think a lot of countries are quite nervous about the idea of attempting to even tweak their constitution. Never mind write a new one. But when you talked about people having aspirations for what it might actually help Chile to accomplish, are people thinking of it as a symbolic document, which will just make some vague and uplifting sentiments about what sort of country they would like Chile to be? Or are they hoping that this is a document which will have practical, real-world implications?
But I think it's important to remember that the impetus for the referendum in the first place to change the constitution was the so-called explosion or estallido of protests in 2019. So this was a government response to that. Now, the current constitution, well, the whole referendum in a way was seen by many as a referendum on Pinochet himself. And as I say, how it helped, it's profoundly polarizing because it did help secure his power while also codifying into law a worldview of private enterprise. And I think that's the key, that Chileans hope that this new constitution will be able to fix some of these inequalities in the country. But for many, it's actually more of a referendum on Pinochet and sort of putting an end to that period of their history.
Lucinda Elliott, thank you. As always, you are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. A global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. At the heart of everything that Novartis does is the patient. Novartis works with the patient community around the world to discover new ways to improve and extend people's lives. Mark Booten is Novartis' head of patient engagement. Laura McKeveny is his predecessor in that role and a 25-year industry veteran. Those Novartis associates working in patient engagement have sought to underscore this company-wide patient commitment over the past 5 years, and indeed to build on it. Mark Booten, you've spoken before about the risks of unconscious bias, about the huge, almost cultural changes you and your colleagues have sought and are seeking to bring about. So that's the scale of the challenge, but what do the key opportunities look like here?
The opportunity truly is huge. And when you look at society as a whole, over the last two decades, everything has been about customization. How do we customize our lives? How do we customize our homes? How do we customize our cars? Many of us have an iPhone, but every one of us has customized it to our own individual needs. And yet, if you're somebody living with a chronic condition, it's almost impossible to customize your health. You're given, if you're lucky, a population-based framework and told this is what you need to do. But it doesn't account for all of your personal circumstances. You know, I say all the time that wellness is not just about biology. Wellness lies at the center of all the determinants of health: biology, social, environmental, economic, and your desired outcomes. And we're beginning to see a movement in health where we're recognizing that it is much more complex than simply giving an individual population-based average treatment. And when we engage people in the development of our medicines and truly understand the outcomes that matter to them, and develop our clinical trials and eventually get to labeling where it says that this medicine is going to help you do these things in these circumstances. And we move that into a delivery system where we're beginning to realize that a population-based approach for people with complex chronic conditions is more expensive, that we have the opportunity to start aligning the right medicine with the right person. That's going to give us better outcomes, but more importantly, people are going to live the best life possible with their families because of that information we're creating now.
That's Mark Booten, Novartis Head of Patient Engagement. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You are back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Muller. Time now to take a look at the business headlines. I'm joined by Ewan Potts at Bloomberg. Ewan, yesterday was Budget Day here in the UK. What did we learn from it?
Andrew, Britain's furlough scheme, among the world's most generous, was extended until June, along with other pandemic relief measures. The Chancellor stuck to the Conservative Party's promise not to raise income taxes, national insurance or VAT, but he did freeze the levels at which income tax kicks in. That sort of, in effect, a tax hike, which he said he was being honest about. And a big jump in the rate of corporation tax from 19 to 25%, although not for another couple of years. That's still competitive by global standards, but politically, it's a screeching U-turn. Sunak's party spent the last 10 years insisting that cutting tax on business is the right thing to do. Not highlighted yesterday, something which has come to light in reading the small print, is the plan to involve a further squeeze on public spending. He's cut an extra £4 billion from non-protected budgets. That's everything except health, defence and education. And that's adding to already challenging targets for those departments. And as to the level of tax increase, the Institute for Fiscal Studies says it's the biggest tax-raising budget since 1993.
We should talk also about a hefty share listing here in London.
Yeah, those little bluey-green boxes and kangaroo logo have become ubiquitous in many towns and cities around the world. And Deliveroo says it's picked London for its share listing. Now, it's a big win for the UK and also for proposed changes to London's stock market rules. Now, the flotation will come with a dual-class share structure, and that will give its founders a greater say in shareholder votes, at least for the first 3 years in which it will apply. Now, the proposed changes to these rules, and they're still proposed, they haven't actually been agreed yet, have been criticised as weakening investor protection. So it's not a change that everybody is in favour of, but assuming it all goes through, it's going to be a big IPO. In its latest funding round, Deliveroo was valued at more than $7 billion.
And just finally, OPEC will be meeting later today. What are we expecting, hoping, fearing from that?
Yeah, as oil demand plummeted during the pandemic, they took drastic action. The OPEC Plus coalition of producers idled 7 million barrels a day of output. Now, after prices, which had briefly dropped below zero last year, Brent crude is up almost 24% this year. It's actually the best two-month start to the year in history. So with that background, a rather rosy background if you're an oil producer, the group meets today to discuss how much of that capacity to bring back to the market. And as ever, the words and actions of Saudi Arabia will be very closely watched. Now, the country triggered a sharp surge in prices at the cartel's January meeting. It's sprung a unilateral cut of 1 million barrels a day onto a rather unsuspecting market. Now, how the Saudis signal they're going to unwind that cut will be crucial today. Most analysts reckon that there's little chance the wider group will hold output at current levels. There's lots and lots of pressure from members, including the UAE and Russia, to pump more. So watch out for headlines from that OPEC meeting later on today.
Ewan Potts, thanks as always. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. You are listening to The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. It is last thing on Thursday, which means that, yes, it's Fernando Augusto Pacheco and the Global Countdown. Yay!
Yay!
I'm trying to whip up some enthusiasm, which may actually be justified because, as attentive listeners will recall, we are going to Togo, and we actually have reasonable, at least statistically disproportionate success in terms of me liking things with our African countdowns.
Well, and Andrew, feeling very inspired this year because there's a lot of debuts here on the Global Countdown. Okay. Togo is one of them.
This is the first time in Togo. I've never been to Togo. I don't know very much about it. It does have, and I'm just hanging this out there, one of my very favorite national flags, though.
Because, it does have a very beautiful
because
flag.
I am something of a flag nerd, and Togo's is a ripper.
And I think you're a diplomacy nerd as well, so you might like number five. Because, you know, I was reading more...
Is it about Togolese diplomacy?
In a way, yes, amazing. Actually. So basically the song, I mean, the description of it, is kind of a diplomatic song between Togo and Benin. They are neighboring countries. So it's a song about unity, about those countries together. And the reason why, because there's an artist from Togo and one from Benin as well.
Is there some sort of looming conflict between Benin and Togo that they are hoping to forestall?
I mean, I have to say, I am not an expert on Togon diplomacy, unfortunately, but
no,
I think...
You've had all week to research this.
I have a feeling they're friendly neighbours. It might be completely wrong, so please, listeners, don't accuse me of anything.
If our many listeners in Togo and Benin would wish to set us right on that, we are all ears, as always. But so this is a song of unity and brotherhood and... stuff.
And it's beautifully sang by Centrinos Raphael, one of the biggest stars in Togo, with Zainab from Benin that I said, and the song is called WAA. Let's have a listen.
That's nice. Benin and Togo getting together. Is there a line in the third verse about how, and we all hate Burkina Faso?
Yes. Well, actually, it's even more about unity because Zainab, she is from Benin, but she was born actually in Côte d'Ivoire. So, you know, there's even more unity there. So
okay. It's
a happy song, Andrew.
Okay, good start. Solid. Liking it. Number four.
Number four, the vibe is different. It's less diplomacy, more sex, I would say. Let's have a listen. It's Tony X with Tokoloto. Chuchu fika jole ma Nyamule na chukbole kona jila.
I mean, it's diplomacy of a sort, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, it's quite a sexy video there, you know, a lot of girls and boys. It's a fun track as well. It's not as diplomatic as the previous one, but I kind of like it. And of course, Tony X is also from Togo. So a lot of, you know, artists from Togo in their charts as well.
They're keeping it local?
Absolutely.
Are they keeping it local at number three?
They are, and we are actually returning to Centrino Raphael, which is very important to say. I mean, he is a very young, one of the biggest stars. He considers himself as an ambassador for his country as well. So, you know, he's a big name. I mean, a lot of people...
Hence his outreach to Benin.
Exactly. This time he's not reaching to anyone. He's just singing by himself, and the song is called Monica. And yes, it is about Monica, and he loves her, and he wants to stay with Monica. Let's have a listen. Comment ça va? Je lui dis ça va. Tata, je suis très content de te voir ce soir. Comment on t'appelle? Elle me dit, elle s'appelle Monica. Maya mama. Actually, I need to correct myself, Andrew. I am wrong. He actually singing with someone else from Ghana, actually. So it's not only Centrino Raphael, it's Stoneway as well from Ghana. So yeah.
But it's all about Monica. Do we know anything about Monica?
We don't, actually. I think it's one of those characters that just come out of nowhere. I was trying to research, is that his real girlfriend?
She hasn't threatened to leave him for a property developer
no,
or anything.
Not this time.
I feel like that's a story we need to come back to.
I love that story.
So that's at number three in Togo this week. What or who is at number two?
Number two is quite an interesting one. He's actually quite a big name
you know, in Africa, in Congo. He's actually from Congo, from Kinshasa. The 43-year-old Fali Ipupa. And this song he sings with Daju, which is a French musician as well. So this actually, even though he's number
there's
two...
There's a lot of hands across the borders going on.
Absolutely.
In Togo.
Love that, love that. And this song is, you know, it's been popular in Congo, in France. So it's not only popular in Togo, I have to say. Very beautifully sang. It's called Uncoupe. Let's hear it. Je te fuis, tu me suis, juste une nuit pour me sentir près de toi. Laisse-moi t'aimer comme on t'a jamais aimé. Je suis tombé amoureux d'un coup, d'un coup, d'un coup. Un coup, un coup, un coup. Pas ben à ta un coup. Un coup, un coup, un coup. Un coup, pas aux techniques. Un coup, un coup, un coup. Trop de plaisir. Un coup, un coup, un coup. On a eu comme un goût. D'un coup, d'un coup.
So this has all been all right this week. I'm feeling weirdly redundant over here, Fernando. I feel like there's some sort of plan to force me out of this segment by just like playing songs that I don't really mind all that much.
Maybe all you need is a dance craze, right, Andrew? I know you love those.
I'm all about the dance craze. Are you trying to build up to the fact that number one in Togo this week is a dance craze?
It is. And, you know, the name of the song, I was like, what does that mean? And apparently it's the name of this new dance craze. The name is quite complicated. Gibok Kirigbo. I hope I said this correctly. And I've seen how to dance. I woke up with a bad neck. It's impossible for me today.
Have you been attempting to do the dance craze?
I did, because it's all about the neck. Okay. Sharp movements on the neck.
Yeah, what could go wrong? I mean, what's it called again, in case any listeners want to look it up, which I'm sure they shouldn't?
It's Gibo Kirigbo by a Togan band called Tufan. And it's been a big hit. It's very... I love the way they dance, but it's too many movements on the neck. I can't at the moment.
So this has been a big hit in both the Togolese pop charts and with Togo's accident and emergency world.
Exactly.
Okay.
Let's see if you're going to like the track, because it is very much for the dance floor. Let's hear it.
It's like... It does sound like he's kind of injured himself.
Yes, he's moving his neck too much.
He's singing like he can barely move his jaw.
And they're very sweet.
Has he put his neck out doing the dance before he recorded it?
God, I have no idea. I think they have amazing neck bones. Oh, that's all I can say.
They'll need them. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you as always. That is all for today's edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Rhys James and Yolin Goffin. Our studio manager was Louis Allen. The Briefing returns at the same time tomorrow. I'm Andrew Mullett. Thanks for listening.